طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Thank you for joining us, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is so important that we bring it to you regularly on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. We have had a wild couple of weeks trying to keep This Week in Palestine on the air or streaming through your computer. As you may know, our host station, WZBC, is a student-operated radio station which is currently not producing programming because the pandemic has required Boston College to send its students home. But we think we have found a way to get back to broadcasting on WZBC at our regular time. In the meantime, KKRN, a progressive volunteer-operated community radio station in Northern California, has graciously agreed to stream This Week in Palestine and did so successfully for the first time last Sunday. Our thanks to them for reaching out and helping us raise the Palestinian narrative. You can access KKRN for streaming at kkrn.org. A new book titled The Movement and the Middle East offers the first assessment of the controversial and ultimately debilitating role of the Arab-Israeli conflict among left-wing activists during a turbulent period of American history. Today we feature the author of that book, historian Michael Fishback, speaking at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. Michael Fishback shows how, as the 1970s wore on, the cleavages emerged within the American left and widened, weakening the movement and leaving a lasting impact that still affects progressive American politics today. We include in our broadcast both the presentation and interaction of Dr. Fishback with the audience in a discussion that directly follows his speech. We begin with his introduction.
So, thank you all for coming. I'm happy to introduce our speaker today, Dr. Michael R. Fishback, Professor of History at Randolph Macon College, who will be presenting his latest book called The Movement and the Middle East, right here, How the Arab-Israeli Conflict Divided the American Left, copies of which are available for purchase at that table over there after the talk. So this book is really quite interesting because it's the first to study the role of the Arab-Israeli conflict among the American left during the turbulent period of the 1960s and 1970s. By the way, I've just edited the copy from the back of the book, so it's not like I've written this myself. These are Michael's words that I'm paraphrasing. So it draws from original sources, including personal interviews and declassified FBI and CIA documents, to present a story of the left-wing responses to the question of Palestine and Israel. His analysis shows the widening gap that emerged as the 1970s wore on within the American left, which both weakened the movement and had lasting effects that still afflict progressive American politics to this day. And just about this gap, I'm going to quote him. He says, quote, "The Arab-Israeli conflict constituted a serious problem for the American left in the 1960s. Pro-Palestinian activists hailed the Palestinian struggle against Israel as part of a fundamental restructuring of the global imperialist order, while pro-Israeli leftists held a less revolutionary worldview that understood Israel as a paragon of democratic socialist virtue." This intra-left debate was in part doctrinal, in part generational, but further woven into this split were sometimes agonizing questions of identity. Jews were disproportionately well represented in the movement, and their personal and communal lives could deeply affect their stances vis-a-vis the Middle East, end quote. That's from the back of the book. So, Michael Fischbach is professor of history at Randolph-Macon College and the author of numerous publications and books, including Black Power in Palestine, Transnational Countries of Color, which he presented here, I think it was last year or the year before. Also, another book, Jewish Property Claims Against Arab Countries. That's from 2008. The Peace Process and Palestinian Refugee Claims, Addressing Claims for Property Compensation and Restitution. That's 2006. And Records of Dispossession, Palestinian Refugee Property and the Arab-Israeli Conflict from 2003. He's the recipient of grants from the MacArthur Foundation and the United States Institute of Peace, and he's presented at numerous academic and diplomatic settings in several countries and continents. So thank you very much. Let's give him a nice welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here at the Palestine Center. Every time I come here, I always remind audiences that way back in the 1980s, when I was a student, a graduate student at Georgetown, I was a student assistant to Professor Hisham Sharabi, and later when I worked on my dissertation, he was on my dissertation committee. I have many fond memories and some inside stories about him that probably nobody knows, and I'll never tell. Let me begin my talk today with a story. I mean, I'm an historian, we like stories. In November of 1966, Daniel Rubin, who was a member of the Central Committee of the Communist Party USA, decried what he called the, quote, upside-down approach to Israel, exhibited by American Jews. By accepting this picture, he said, Jews in the U.S. usually unwittingly find themselves on the side of U.S. imperialism in opposition to national liberation movements. Rubin was upholding the party line, the CP party line in the 60s, that what best served American Jews was not to support Israel blindly, but see that the real question in the Middle East was one of the struggle to overthrow imperialism, which was the common enemy of both Jews and Arabs. And Rubin also waxed personal in his 1966 commentary, stating, quote, as an American Jewish communist, I feel ashamed and angry that a Jewish government coming from a people who have known so much oppression should oppress Arabs within Israel and play the U.S. imperialist game of supporting their oppression in neighboring countries, unquote. But not all Jewish communists agreed. Indeed, just 6 or 7 months later, when the Communist Party leadership denounced Israel for, quote, aggression in the 1967 war, comrade Sid Resnick strongly objected. For Resnick, Israel was merely defending itself against a threatened Arab genocide. And he said, quote, the Arab chauvinist threat to Israel's existence was real in May and June of 1967, and de-Zionizing the state of Israel and converting it into an Arab-Palestine state is impossible without destroying the people and the state of Israel. Resnick further said, within left-wing movements, Jewish and non-Jewish radicals ought to challenge the sham internationalism which glorifies Palestinian Arab terrorists and runs interference for Arab chauvinism. The fact that two Jewish members of the same left-wing political party held such divergent and mutually antagonistic attitudes toward the Arab-Israeli conflict is illustrative of a major problem that ultimately weakened the white American left in the 1960s, and which is the subject of my book. Which side, Israel or the Palestinians, deserved the support of left-wing activists during that tumultuous period of time? While almost everyone on the left, the white left and the black left for that matter, agreed on the need to end the Vietnam War, support the black freedom struggle at home, and strive for a new politics in America, the left nonetheless was bitterly crippled and weakened by a major split in the 60s and 70s over the Arab-Israeli conflict. Indeed, this question of whether to support Israel or the Palestinians hurt the left at the time, ultimately helped, among many factors, lead to its ultimate weakening and basically demise by the 1980s. And the fact that, as I mentioned, that left-wing Jews were prominently represented on both sides of that split superheated and worsened the divisions that were already there as a kind of Jewish civil war broke out over the question of Israel and Palestine on the left. Today, what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about these varying left-wing attitudes toward Israel and the Palestinians in the 60s and 70s, go into greater detail about why they had such tremendous impact on the left, and also to discuss the painful and sometimes ugly debate among Jewish left-wing activists themselves, and conclude with a few thoughts about what this can tell us about progressive American politics today in advance of the 2020 elections. Almost as soon as Israel launched the 1967 war, with preemptive attacks on several Arab countries' military forces, splits emerged within the American left over what to do. These splits grew deeper when black militants like those in the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, black militants at the National Conference for New Politics in Chicago in the summer, both in the summer of 67, strongly supported the Palestinians and criticized Israel quite vehemently. Youthful New Left activists, largely white, were among those who quickly picked up on this and began championing the Palestinians as an example of a third world liberation struggle that American leftists should solidly support. The Yippies, for instance, the famous combination of the hippies and the New Left, are well known in American history of the 60s, but how many of you know today that figures like Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin were strongly supportive of the Palestinians? Abby Hoffman once said, quote, "I hate Israel and want to see the Palestinians triumph. I am violently anti-Israel and no longer believe they have a right to exist." Jerry Rubin, the he used to call, people called him the clown prince of 60s leftism, said, quote, "I do not believe in freedom for Jews at the expense of Arabs," and once quipped that if Moses were alive today, he'd be an Arab guerrilla. The fact that two prominent Jewish members of the New Left sided so strongly with the Palestinians was emblematic of other trends. Within the major left-wing student group, Students for Democratic Society, certain leaders began also demanding that their organization, SDS, support the Palestinians as an example of an anti-imperialist global struggle. An SDS publication written by a Jewish professor named Larry Hochman said in 1967, quote, "A Jewish state has been established in the midst of the Arab world without the invitation or consent of the indigenous population. The Jewish immigration occurred," Hochman continued, "and could only have occurred under the aegis of Western colonial control." And 2 years later, the SDS publication New Left Notes noted in a series of articles that compared what Zionism had done to the Palestinians to what white settlers had done to Indians in North America. But very early on, SDS began receiving considerable flack and blowback for this stance. Indeed, in 69, the same publication, New Left Notes, featured a series of letters to the editors from frustrated SDS members, quite angry at the pro-Palestinian slant that was coming out in the pages of their newspaper. One letter to the editor said that the New Left Notes was, quote, "presenting the Zionists as racist bad guys and the Arabs as anti-imperialist good guys." Clearly, the lines were being drawn. Beyond SDS and Yippies, the student movement was another example where sharp divisions in an otherwise common attitude towards stopping the war in Vietnam broke out. Pro-Palestinian campus groups began emerging on college campuses, particularly starting in 1969, when the Palestinian guerrilla movement was much in the global news. In the spring of 1969, Palestine Week activities took place at many schools, including Berkeley, UCLA, Madison, Columbia, and the University of Chicago. Groups like the American Friends for Free Palestine emerged at the University of Virginia, and at Indiana Bloomington, the Palestine Solidarity Committee emerged. Yet here again, there was immediate reaction. Pro-Israeli groups on campuses began pushing back. Left-wing student groups like Am Yisrael at SUNY Albany and the Jewish student movement at Northwestern emerged with great force. In fact, so divisive did this question become on college campuses that, for instance, a teach-in on the Middle East at Columbia in April of 1969 descended into fistfights among those in attendance. And the following year, a similar event prompted the New York City police to intervene after members of the Jewish Defense League began attacking members of the audience. So clearly, the youthful New Left was split over the war in the Middle East, even as they could agree on the need to end the war in Southeast Asia. And outside of the New Left, the so-called Old Left, these issues emerged again with great force and divisiveness. Old Left groups like the Workers' World Party, which was the only organization led by Americans actually to protest against Israel while the 67 war was going on, were solidly supportive of the Palestinians. So too was the Socialist Workers' Party, which developed fairly sophisticated theoretical understandings of the conflict. But on the other hand, some in so-called old left political parties were quite uncertain. And as I alluded in my opening remarks, nowhere was this more evident than within the Communist Party USA. The party leaders, as I mentioned, had condemned Israel for starting the war in 67, and party bosses tried to enforce party unity. But many Jewish comrades in particular, and there were a large number of Jews within the Communist Party, as in other left-wing groups, rebelled against this hostile attitude toward Israel. They claimed that they were, quote, pro-Israel, but non-Zionist. And one such party member noted, quote, but on one issue, left non-Zionists unreservedly agree with Zionists, that Israel now has an inalienable right to exist. Indeed, the ever-watchful FBI, which had dozens, in fact hundreds of informers, gleefully wrote in 1970 that disputes over the Middle East were, quote, a crisis of the first order of magnitude within the CP and one from which it frankly never recovered. Also in the old left, there was not only uncertainty, but outright support for Israel. And this was most clearly seen in the Socialist Party of America and its offshoots in the 70s, groups like the Social Democrats USA and the Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee. They believed, certainly starting in 1970, Michael Harrington, at that time a young Carl Gershman, that the proper choice for left-wing Americans, certainly for socialists, was to embrace Israel as a bastion of socialist progress in a sea of backward Arabs supported by Soviet communist totalitarianism. Now, moving away from the New Left and the Old Left, there were other aspects of the American left, maybe not the true left, but at least progressive Americans that also found themselves quite divided over this issue. One thinks, for example, of the movement to end the war in Vietnam. One pacifist stated the dilemma of how people fighting to stop the war in Vietnam should deal with war in the Middle East this way when he said, quote, raising the question of the Middle East at peace meetings seems to lead to a most disconcerting silence. This balancing act about what to do impacted the major anti-war group in the late 60s, the MOB, which fought hard to, despite efforts by some left-wing groups, to include denunciation of Israel's actions in the Middle East along with American actions in Southeast Asia. The MOB studiously avoided taking on other questions. Outside the MOB, anti-war figures like Martin Luther King Jr. similarly faced a dilemma of how to remain morally consistent in their denunciation of war and military action across the board, yet not offend important domestic constituencies. King eventually tried to have it both ways, and noted in September of 67, several months after the war, that, quote, neither military measures, which was talking at Israel, nor a stubborn effort to reverse history, he was talking to the Arab world, can provide a permanent solution for peoples who need and deserve both development and security. But King also later admitted, and we know this because the FBI was bugging the telephone, and we now have the records, that this was, quote, the darkest days of his life, trying to figure out what to do about being a Nobel Peace Prize winner who was about to lead a pilgrimage to the Middle East, which he had to cancel, how to address, if to address, this particular example of war and conflict when attacking American policy in Vietnam had been anguishing him enough as it was. Other peace groups, like Women's Strike for Peace, never came up with a unified position on the war. When the anti-war hero Daniel Berrigan in 1973, in the wake of the 73 Arab-Israeli War, denounced both the Arabs and Israel, he was roundly criticized, not for what he said about the Arab world, but for the fact that he had dared to criticize Israel. And in other cases, anti-war activists openly supported Israel to the degree that some, particularly liberals, earned the nickname, quote, doves for war, for their seeming, in some people's eyes, their seeming contradictions in supporting military action and the use of napalm in the Middle East, but of denouncing military action and the use of American-supplied napalm in the Middle East. Indeed, liberal anti-war figures like Robert F. Kennedy in Congress, Eugene McCarthy also in the Senate, George McGovern, again in the Senate, all strongly supported Israel, despite being doves on Vietnam. And the perceived contradiction was so severe that in June 1967, shortly after the war, a conference was actually held in New York City called Israel and Vietnam, There Is a Difference, by which pro-Israeli peaceniks said that it is perfectly consistent to support Israel in the Middle East, yet denounce the war. And throughout all of this, the anti-war movement, the old left, the new left, the peace movement, the fact that progressives and left-wing activists were disproportionately had a large number of Jewish members made all of this much more painful, much more bitter. As the painful history of the Jewish people led different liberal and left-wing Jews to very different conclusions about how their activism in America intersected or did not intersect with the question of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Some left-wing Jews strongly objected to attacks on Israel and singled out in particular their fellow Jews for a great deal of opprobrium. For example, the academics at Harvard, Michael Walzer and Martin Peretz, both younger in those days, they're still around, took to the pages of the left-wing magazine Ramparts to blast the left for its attacks on Israel. And Peretz himself, later writing in Commentary magazine, said, quote, those of us in the radical community then for whom Israel's rights are on the same moral plane as the rights of the Vietnamese have drawn a kind of moral cutoff line on the issue. Other radicals cannot deny or reasonably plead against it in the name of unity. Other left-wing Jews denounced pro-Palestinian Jews as self-hating, who suffered from various Jewish pathologies. Among these were scholars like Seymour Martin Lipset, who argued that the new left, quote, privileged emotion and irrationality over reason. The Arabs represented the former, Israel the latter. But on the other hand, other left-wing Jews bravely called upon their fellow Jews to honestly examine their own strident pro-Zionist feelings. Just days after the 67 war, for instance, the noted writer I.F. Stone wrote, quote, it is a moral tragedy to which no Jew worthy of our best prophetic tradition could be insensitive, that a kindred people was left homeless in the task of making new homes for the remnants of the Hitler Holocaust. Other left-wing Jews like Paul Jacob, Noam Chomsky, and Arthur Waskow similarly argued that their fellow Jews on the left adopt a more dispassionate analysis of the conflict. Now, as the 60s waited, or shall we say faded into the 1970s, America was changing. The left was in retreat. But there still were left-wing groups operating both above ground and underground in the early and mid-70s. And they, too, were adopting stances on the Middle East. Certainly the bombers of the Weather Underground were stridently pro-Palestinian and hailed Palestinian militants such as Leila Khaled. It was also true of the above-ground Marxist parties that tried to form a new movement in the 70s, commonly called the New Communist Movement. Groups like the Revolutionary Communist Party USA and the October League. Yet elsewhere in the 70s, the new 70s left similarly found itself either openly supporting Israel or suffering from great division within the women's movement, pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian women, notably Jews on both sides, Bella Abzug, Betty Friedan on the one hand, for example, groups such as Women Against Imperialism in the San Francisco Bay Area, on the other, stridently supporting the Palestinians. And so, by the time we got to the mid-late 70s, this kind of intra-left dispute in the left caused some who sided with Israel to simply abandon the left altogether. Notably, I'm thinking of certain figures within the socialist movement who left the left and became, as we should say, charter members of the neoconservative movement. And many of them, including people like Norman Podhoretz, have openly stated that what they perceived as the left's mistreatment of Israel in the 60s had much to do with their own rightward turn. To conclude, certainly the left in America took a beating after the 70s were over. And I argue that years of disagreement about the Arab-Israeli conflict was one of many factors that contributed to the downfall of the left. But it's important to point out, though, that the idea of leftists still divided is something that outlasted that, and certainly we see still featuring today. Certainly today it is much more, let's put it this way, people can discuss Palestinians, Palestinian rights, Palestinian liberation, what have you, publicly much more easily today than five decades ago. Whereas that kind of talk came from radicals in the 60s, might have been considered extreme. Even those outside the left, in more broader progressive and liberal society in America, can discuss such matters today. Certainly when it comes to young people, organizations like Students for Justice in Palestine, those who support the BDS movement, whatever one thinks about it, the discourse of Palestinian rights today has really become a permanent part of the progressive political landscape. On the other hand, and indeed, the historian Rashid Khalidi noted in 2015, he said, quote, "There's a much higher level of discussion of matters related to Palestine than ever before, especially in the field of Middle East studies and among students on college campuses." That, as I said, is certainly true. But on the other hand, it is also true that pro-Israeli forces in society at large and on college campuses are symbiotically also much stronger than they were in the 60s. Today, campus groups such as Campus Watch, the Secret Canary Mission, have set up internet sites designed to monitor, expose, counteract pro-Palestinian views on college campuses. Efforts have also been made to equate anti-Zionist critiques with anti-Semitism and therefore label it as a form of college hate speech. So in presenting, in conclusion, the story of the divisions within the left in the 60s and 70s that showed that Left-wing identity and action were thrown into very sharp relief by how one viewed the Arab-Israeli conflict. And these divisions were worsened by the fact that left-wing American Jews were supporting both sides. This story is a cautionary tale, I would argue, for today. What remains of the tiny American left today is fairly solidly united behind one point of view, a pro-Palestinian one. But if you move a little bit further to the right among progressives, liberals more generally, where to stand on the Middle East is still as divisive today as it was then. And nowhere has this become clearer than within the Democratic Party today, which I'm including as liberal. By no means am I saying it's left-wing. Where the splits between supporters of Israel and the Palestinians are deepening. Indeed, when the 2018 elections brought into the House of Representatives three Democratic women who were fairly public in their pro-Palestinian sentiments, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, some high-level party officials were mortified. Because those three women represented a trend within the Democratic Party, where three important constituencies, young people, women, and people of color, were increasingly abandoning the Democratic Party's traditionally solidly pro-Israeli stance. And indeed, within just 3 days after those three women were seated in the House, a new group called the Democratic for Majority for Israel was established to try to shore up traditional pro-Israeli stances within the party. These divisions are also seen more recently when Democratic Party hopeful Bernie Sanders has called for conditioning U.S. foreign aid to Israel upon Israel's need to, quote, fundamentally change its policy toward Palestinians. Clearly, liberals in the Democratic Party are quite worried about these kinds of voices arising within the Democratic Party. And traditional party bosses, the Nancy Pelosi's, the Chuck Schumer's, are clearly worried. And they have reason to be. According to a 2018 poll carried out by the Pew Research Center, the number of self-described liberal Democrats who sympathize with the Palestinians was nearly double the number of those sympathetic to Israel. Another poll from the Pew Research Center from April of last year, 2019, showed that just 27% of Americans under the age of 30 held a favorable view of the Israeli government. Traditional pro-Israeli members of the Democratic Party, as I've said, have been quite concerned about these developments. Presidential hopeful Joe Biden has noted, quote, the idea, referencing Bernie Sanders, the idea that we would draw military aid from Israel on the condition that they change a specific policy, I find to be absolutely outrageous. More recently, the Democratic Majority for Israel has begun airing attack ads against Bernie Sanders. And in last night's already famous debate between Mike Bloomberg and Bernie Sanders, when much was made about the self-described capitalist, the self-described socialist, in reference to what I've been talking about here, both Jewish, by the way, I think what I haven't heard a single person say today is the elephant in the room, that they share very little, not simply over socialism and capitalism, but what to do about the Middle East. Sanders' views I've already outlined. As for Bloomberg, Aryeh Mekel, who was Israel's consul general in New York, described him to the Jerusalem Post as, quote, a liberal New York Jew who's very supportive of Israel, saying that candidates like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren would be problematic for Israel. Aryeh Mekel said that from an Israeli point of view, Bloomberg would be the best candidate. Former ambassador to Israel to the United States, Michael Oren, who's known Bloomberg for years, characterized him as a friend who would be very good for Israel. Quote, I had a lot of contact with Bloomberg, and he was very upset about the Obama administration's treatment of us. He is a Jewish guy who grew up in Boston suburbs. He's not a progressive. He has a deep tribal connection to Israel. Bloomberg and Sanders' different stances on the question mirror those of other divisions within the party. And what I'm saying is that regardless of whether you or I or anybody else, whatever we feel about which side to support in the Arab-Israeli conflict, the Democratic Party, if it hopes to create a unified coalition against President Trump in 2020, in November, is going to have to deal with this internal dissension over the Middle East. There are certainly other things going on, great divisions within the Democratic Party, but that's one that doesn't get talked about as much. And given the experience of what happened to liberal left-wing Americans 5 decades ago, I think, therefore, it's a cautionary tale for progressive politicians today. Worsening this is the immensely close relationship between President Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, which further puts liberal Americans, particularly American Jews, not only, in the Democratic Party in a difficult position between standing with Israel, and Trump has been arguably the most adopted some of the most pro-Israeli policies in recent years of any president in decades, with their otherwise disdain of President Trump as members of the Democratic Party. It's putting him in a very strange position. So to end my talk, certainly the research that I did on this question showed a lot about the left's conflicted attitudes toward the Arab-Israeli conflict back in the 60s and early 70s. But as I said, I believe it also illustrates some of the ongoing problems that progressive Americans today, whether in the Democratic Party or further to the left, still have, situating themselves into a discourse where practically the rest of the world, the liberal, what's called progressive and left-wing forces in the rest of the world, are fairly unified behind one point of view. And so with that, I think I'll end, and I appreciate your patience, and I look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Thanks very much.
So the thing is, I think that the real difference is how the Republican Party has embraced, you know, the hard nationalist view, the hardline view in Israel. How much further it's clear to anybody that Israel is very right-wing. I mean, in the 60s and even the 70s, you know, they're a Labor Party. They're, all that stuff is still quite murky. So those, how do those factors change this? It just seems like it's a tougher hand for the pro-Israel liberals, even, to actually stand their ground when you look at what the Republicans here do with the issue, and how the Israeli leadership and most of the population are right behind it.
Well, I agree, and that's what I was saying at the end, is that progressive Americans that still have sympathies on any number of levels with Israel are indeed faced with a conundrum between how to balance that. Traditionally, both the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, and certainly those further to the left of the Democrats could disagree about many things, but there was a bipartisan consensus on that. But you're right, the fact that in recent decades, the Republican Party, which, you know, 50, 60 years ago, before Nixon, was not at all seen as sympathetic to Israel, in part because of neoconservatives who defected from the left, in part because of the increasing embrace of right-wing evangelical Christians by the Republican Party. There are a number of factors that have, and recently things like post 9/11 world, and you know we're all in the same trench against you know bad guys from that part of the world, has certainly deepened that. But I agree with you; it presents some real problems for progressives in the Democratic Party or anywhere else who can't stand Trump, who don't like Netanyahu, but yet feel that, you know, I don't want to jump on this anti-Israel bandwagon. I don't particularly have any advice for them, but you're right. You put your finger on a real problem that's challenging them. And I think here, and then over here, and here, and here.
Michael, I was hoping you were going to resolve this conundrum for us.
Okay. Another 3 minutes.
Instead of just describing it. And for my own personal journey, which I could identify with most of your talk, the way I resolved it was by thinking that the world isn't just Vietnam and Israel. There are other countries, too. And frankly, some of my political heroes on Capitol Hill, including Bernie Sanders, are not consistently anti-imperialist when it comes to Venezuela, for example. And I use that as an example of how I felt more comfortable criticizing Israel by realizing that U.S. support for Israel is contingent on its playing a supportive role in American imperialism. So if I want to be consistently anti-imperialist, I have to criticize Israel for playing that enabling supportive role. And why isn't that a reasonable way of resolving this conundrum?
Well, my role in the book was to be to excavate and this history allow. There's a lot of, it's a narrative history, by the way. So many people are speaking. I quote people directly, and so I prefer, rather than me talk about how I necessarily view it all, let people on all sides at that time say it. But there are some very painful wrestlings that I wrote about in the book. Someone in SDS and later the Weather Underground named Naomi Jaffe, saying how anguishing it was for her to do what you just said. She said, I felt like I had to be morally consistent with my left-wing views. I could not make Israel an exception to that rule. An SDS and also a Weather Underground figure named Mark Rudd, I quote in there, saying very similar kinds of things. But there were others, you know, like I said, I think of Carl Gershman, who's now the head of the National Endowment for Democracy, saying that, you know, as a socialist, not to mention as a Jew, Israel was a socialist, you know, there was Golda Meir, the Labor Party. They were in the same trench against Soviet totalitarianism, and the socialists and the communists always hated each other. And so for me, it was perfectly consistent as a socialist, as a Jew, to see Israel as eminently deserving of our support. So, no, I myself am not opining on things, but I certainly do, in the book, let people speak from all perspectives, laying out how they as left-wing people or they as Jewish left-wing people wrestled with deep issues of personal identity and how that should... I mean, there are people I quote in there that said, it's precisely because I was a Jew, because I was taught there can never be another Holocaust, that I support the Palestinians. And of course, you had others who said, you're betraying everything it means to be a Jew. You know, the 11th commandment, don't help Hitler finish the job. So I encourage, you know, not to sell the book, I'm not going to get anything from this, but I do recount people's own painful grapplings in that way.
I didn't get to see your other book, you probably mentioned that, and Black Power. But my understanding from the book of Kwame Ture, Stanley Carmichael, he had the whole chapter about Palestine. Mm-hmm. And there he indicated how Martin Luther King was... completely, he ended up siding with Israel in whether Palestine or Israel, and he sided with Israel, and that's the reason why Stokely Carmichael, which is again Kwame Ture, he and other civil rights movement activists decided to get out, and I think the reason one of the establishment of the SNCC, it's also because of the issue of Palestine. I just thought to bring it this and see if you have probably mentioned this or your thought about this.
Yes, I did write about King, and I wrote even more about him in the companion book. Martin Luther King Jr., just very briefly, actually traveled to Jerusalem and the West Bank in March of 1959. He actually fell ill, he and his wife Coretta, and were treated at the YMCA hostel in East Jerusalem by a local doctor named Viken Kalbion. If anybody knows Anira, he's a well-known figure. Now, he's ethnically Armenian, but grew up basically in Arab East Jerusalem and was himself a refugee, lost his house in 48. And he told me that when he treated Martin Luther King Jr., he knew who he was. Even by 1959, he was fairly well known. And he said that King asked me, as I got up to leave, would you please stay? We'd like to hear the Arab point of view about this conflict, because in America, we don't hear it. And so here a man who himself was a refugee, not a Palestinian Arab, but a refugee, told Martin Luther King about the story of Palestine from his perspective. He arranged for a meeting for King, a dinner that was included some, one of the Nusaybis, I think Anwar Nusaybi and some others, the Jerusalem mayor. And so King was very, very well aware of what was the complexities. He later confided to Jesse Jackson shortly before he died that the Palestinian thing is going to be the next big thing in the world. And he was very conflicted about what to say when the war happened in 67. So yes, he always supported Israel's right to exist. He made that very clear. But he always took care in the next sentence to say that we need to address, he said, economics. He never got into politics. The economic grievances that drive Arab anger at Israel. Because this was a time when he was being called on to denounce black violence in the inner cities. The summer of 67, Detroit, Newark, things were going, over 50 cities were going up in flame. And he was constantly being asked to denounce that. And he said, I'll denounce it but we have to deal with the economic grievances that are helping to fuel black resentment in the city. So he adopted, he kind of cut and paste that attitude toward the Palestinians. He never really publicly addressed the political dimensions, but he did say, always, Israel has a right to exist, period, full stop, but peace will only come when, particularly economic development, improves the standards of living. Now, pro-Palestinians would say that's kind of a halfway solution, but my point is, I think King's stance was much more nuanced than I think a lot of people think.
Thank you very much. I'd like to ask you to comment further on two things that you said. One was regarding the cautionary tale regarding pro-Palestinian rights people in Congress and so on, on the Democratic side. Mm-hmm. Is it a concern that it will split the party? Is it something else? Because the environment today is so different from what it was in the 60s and so on in terms of acknowledgement of the what has been done to the Palestinians and so on. Mm-hmm. And secondly, you talked about pro-Israel groups on campus and how strong they are. My sense is that they're really on the defensive. They get a lot of outside support, a lot of money, but could you comment on that as well compared to on campuses sentiments which are more pro-Palestinian?
Right. Yeah, when I said a cautionary tale, it was simply a way of saying that regardless of what I personally think or anybody else thinks, is that the Democratic Party is going to have to deal with this. The challenges it's facing coming up in the election is not simply do we have a moderate or a socialist or who's more electable, but the fact that again, whether one likes it or not, particularly youth, particularly people of color, constituencies the Democratic Party are going to have come out and vote in large numbers, have shown, according to polls, a decidedly supportive view of the Palestinians that is at odds with the party's traditional stance. So whether you bemoan that or think it's a good thing, that's a reality. And to to galvanize those people to be on board in an anti-Trump coalition is something the party's just going to have to deal with. Because for decades, people within the party and those who voted Democratic have felt that their sentiments on the Middle East are just ignored by the party on the basis that, well, you're going to vote for us anyway. You're going to vote against Reagan, right? You're going to vote against Bush, right? We know you, we have you, so we really don't have to consider your needs. And I think that's just becoming harder for mainstream Democrats to say anymore. Because, again, just like the 60s, this is intersecting with a lot of other things going on in the party. How left do we want to be? It's all part of a thing. And that's why I said it's a cautionary tale. Again, whether one likes either side is something the Democrats are going to have to deal with. Your second question, in a real short answer, the collapse of the peace process, the election of Netanyahu, the start of the BDS movement, these were all in the first decade of the 21st century, increasingly put strong support of Israel on the defensive because of things like intersectionality, that increasingly more and more people around the world and the U.S., blacks, sexual minorities like gays and lesbians, women, were sensing, and again, whether you like this or not, an intersexual commonality with the sufferings of the Palestinians. You can add to that the Gaza, the periodic Gaza invasions. And so many people started sensing a real problem. The Israeli government, I think it was 2015, tasked the Strategic Affairs Ministry with developing programs to combat BDS as an existential threat. There's an Israeli nonprofit in 2010 called the Re'ut Institute, that developed a plan. This has been copied over here, groups like Israel on Campus, the David Project, and you're right, there has been a lot of money coming in. Added to that, voices combating this idea of intersectional solidarity among all oppressed peoples. One of the people who dismissed that the most vociferously was a fellow named Alan Dershowitz, whom we've heard about recently. So yes, there's been a lot of alarm that the Palestinians sort of have a corner on the oppression market and they're getting other oppressed people to support them, and we need to do something about that. One of the more interesting recent developments has been the rise in articles on the internet that have said that Jews, even Ashkenazic Jews, are not white. They are indigenous people of color from the Middle East. And this has been, again, whether you agree or disagree, it's been part of a campaign to say, you see, we too are an oppressed people of color. Why is everybody only supporting the Palestinians? So it has been a great... I'm just saying what's been happening, you know. One guy so far as to say, as far as indigeneity, he said no reasonable person would say that being an indigenous ends at a certain time period. You could, it is of great concern, and that does explain some of this reaction and some of the efforts in state legislatures to kind of criminalize a support for BDS and other things like that.
You have been listening to Professor Michael Fishback speaking at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. We hope to be broadcasting next Sunday morning on WZBC, but if not, please stream us live on your computer at kkrn.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.